Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, and you're listening to Southern Fried True Crime. This is where I would normally warn you about graphic content, but the only warning you need today is for explicit language. Today, I've got a treat for you guys, and definitely for me. I got to talk to Karen Slaughter again about her new book, False Witness. It's an amazing book, and I hope you guys pick it up. If not at your favorite small bookseller, then please put it on hold at your local library. Karen grew up in libraries, and she put her considerable clout behind a project that desperately needed attention. She is the founder of the Save the Libraries Project, a nonprofit organization established to support libraries and library programming. Her standalone novel, Pieces of Her, was picked up by Netflix and is currently being filmed. The film stars Toni Collette and Bella Heathcote. Netflix hasn't given a release date yet, but I cannot wait to binge this series. If you haven't already read the book, you've got time, and it's in paperback. And Karen's Grant County and Will Trent series are also in development for television. Karen's not only one of the most successful and prolific thriller writers in America, she is a woman standing out in a genre that was long dominated by men. She's also a Southern woman with a great reverence for Southern writers, which shines through in her work. Her uniquely feminist Southern voice has entranced fans and critics alike. A native of Georgia, Karen Slaughter lives in Atlanta, and she is great fun to chat with. I hope y'all enjoy this interview as much as I did talking to Karen. Well, welcome back to the show, Karen. It's really nice to see you again. It was May 2018, the last time we talked. I'm sure you don't remember. That's been a long time ago.
Oh, we were so young then. What happened?
I know. I feel much, much older. I know. I remember talking a lot about VC Andrews and, you know, fangirling you pretty hard. But I did go back and listen, actually. And it was really funny because we mentioned that Cosby had just been convicted. Yeah. And now he's been released. Isn't that weird?
It is. But it just shows you how well the law works for people who have a lot of money.
Yeah, it also brought to mind, you know, I love to cuss as much as you do. And one of your things in your new book, prosecutorial fuckery.
Yes.
Like they did some stuff they shouldn't have done. They fucked up and, you know.
Yeah, that was some Epstein shit too. Mm-hmm. Like who gets these promises from prosecutors like that?
I don't know, but I don't know how anyone thought you could use anything from a civil deposition into a criminal trial. Like,
well, we should also tell people look into it because he wasn't exonerated. He literally got off on a technicality.
Oh, 100%. And he admitted everything he did. And I just thought it was really interesting that at both interviews, that's what had happened. And of course, no, certainly not. Well, let's talk about False Witness. I loved it. I always feel like, again, a fangirl. Your standalones are incredible. Every time I read one, I'm like, oh, now this one is my favorite. But I really, really enjoyed it. And when we were talking about the Me Too movement and that women are not believed, I kind of felt like, and I don't want to give too much away about the book, obviously, but this was sort of a driving force in the book.
Well, it was, but also, you know, the first part of the book opens a few years after the whole Amy Fisher, Jodi Bonifuco thing.
Yeah.
And people remember from the myriad Lifetime movies and that sort of stuff. Though no offense to the stars, who are wonderful people, I'm sure, that she was really vilified and people just took away her right to be a teenage girl who was molested by an older man and manipulated by an older man. And, you know, it happens a lot when young girls are victimized that suddenly they lose that right to be young and they're called women. And it was really startling to go back and read a lot of that. I mean, people have obviously gone through some dark moments of the heart about the whole Britney Spears coverage.
Yeah.
And that horrible conservatorship and, you know, all of that. But that was not unusual around that time frame and well before to treat women that way, particularly young women. And so I wanted to use that as a starting off point and talk about the fact that, hey, guys, not a hell of a lot has changed.
Yeah.
And even if we're talking about it and saying it's wrong, it's still not changing.
No, it's not stopping anything. It's not changing anything, but it's really interesting the way you used it. Cause I do agree that especially, I'm sure you dug into the time frame and looked around at some trials and stuff then, and what she was right about what would have happened. But again, I don't want to give too much away, but the other big theme is the shame and the guilt, the it's all my fault mantra that Lee had. That's still so relevant, you know, even though we know better.
Yeah, women tend to blame themselves when bad things happen, you know, and it's just kind of hardwired into us from a very young age that we're completely responsible for the entire world. And yet, though we are technically a slim majority of the population, we're treated as a minority class. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this book I'm reading called Unwell Women. About it's nonfiction about just how historically women have been marginalized, and it, you know, going back to the medieval ages or even like Hippocrates, and how they believed that women's wombs moved around.
Yeah, that's crazy stuff.
I mean, it was illegal to do an autopsy, right? So mm-hmm. they weren't allowed to look at where organs were or anything like that. So they were like, hey, well, women's wombs move around the body, and you know, if they're being mouthy, give them something bitter and it'll push the womb back down. Or, you know, this explains menstrual cramps and bleeding. And I mean, it's just crazy. And then it takes up what's happening in biblical times. And I mean, spoiler alert, they want to control women's reproductive system.
They always have.
Right?
Yeah.
And to view women as lesser beings and vessels for men. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I'm writing, I'm really conscious that there is an ideology, whether it's through the incels or certain extreme right-wing personalities who still feel that way about women. And yeah. who are like really emboldened right now to talk openly about it, which is great because it's, you know, when they use the coded language, it's easy to hide behind.
Yeah.
We're really like just being straight with people right now, which in some ways is a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It's really great. And I've always loved it. And I know you said it in a quote before that you feel a great responsibility when you talk about or when you write about violence against women, you know, for this reason. You know, you want it to be real, not titillating. And it's one of the reasons I've always loved your books. I get put off by male writers who use it differently. And I've always respected your books and watched that evolution. And I think it's great.
Well, thank you very much. You know, it's something I work very hard on. And there, I mean, I hate to be like, not all men.
No, yeah.
No one ever cared about not all women. But there are, I mean, it was acceptable to write that way for such a long time.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, growing up, I mean, one of the reasons why I write about violence against women specifically in an unflinching way is it's very easy to brush it under the rug or mm-hmm. to soften the language about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll say sexual assault instead of rape.
Yeah.
You know, or we'll quantify it in some way. But when I was growing up, my grandmother was being horrifically abused by my grandfather. Mm. And I remember when we would go to their house for Sunday dinner, you know, sometimes my grandmother would have a cut or a black eye or occasionally a broken bone. And my uncles teased her about being so clumsy.
Oh.
As I got older, I was like, yeah,
she's not clumsy.
And I knew just from that point on that being silent did not help my grandmother. In fact, it helped my grandfather by not talking about it. And so that's the kind of book I want to write, is where we talk about it, we show it for what it is. I mean, certainly if that's not the kind of book you're interested in, there are so many other great authors you yeah. can read. But for me, that's what I want to read as a reader, and that's what I want to talk about as a writer.
I run into the same problem in podcasting is, you know, how much detail do you give without upsetting some people? But I have to be real. You don't feel the horror of what happened to the victim. And, you know, my stories are always victim oriented. I start and end with them and how it affected their lives. And you have to tell the truth. You know, there's always a line in some place, but I really respect that. And I love that you're so careful with it. And something that, of course, I noticed in rereading, I told you I did this with my surgeries, but the evolution of basically social topics in your books have gotten so much greater. And I don't know that you've ever been more on point with what's going on than you have been with this book. I mean, and it wasn't just the pandemic. It was everything. You want to talk about that a little bit?
You know, I think pandemic has just been a big magnifying glass for topics yeah. that you've talked about for years. You know, me, a lot of us, whether it's racial inequality or social injustice or how we treat our prison population and people who work in the incarceration mm-hmm. business, how poorly they are treated, you know, it just really magnified everything wrong with society right now. And to me, that's what crime fiction is supposed to write about, you know, whether it's Dickens writing about street mm-hmm. urchins or Poe, you know, talking about a detective working against the grain, or, you know, there's just a long history in crime fiction about talking about society in a way that holds up a mirror to us.
Yeah.
And so that's what I wanted to do, particularly with this book, is capture just some of the rage that people are feeling right now. I mean, if you think about what we've been through, not just the pandemic, but after every single war America has ever experienced, there has been a rise in populism and a rise in white nationalism, Ku Klux Klan, through white supremacist movements, through all of that. So what we're seeing now, we only need to look back at history to understand it. I mean, and how people are responding to the vaccines. That's something I had to incorporate into my book very late in the game. And when I was trying to figure out how to frame responses to it, I looked back at the polio vaccine.
That's interesting.
When that came along. And in the early days, of course, there was some legitimate criticism about it. But once it was effective, once it was really stopping the polio pandemic in its tracks, you had people saying, well, I don't trust it. Science, or it's the government trying to track me, or, you know, you wonder what these people would have said about electricity. Certainly they would have been against that. A lot of that, you know, is really something that is not new in society. I mean, you think about the fact that we are here as Americans in a country called America because George Washington at Valley Forge mandated all his soldiers be inoculated against smallpox. I mean, that's why we won.
It's incredible, right?
So our country was founded on this vaccine mandate, basically. So, you know, but history just tells us that there's always going to be people who are hesitant about these things, or who are anti these things, anti-progress in some ways. So, you know, and I understand hesitancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be like, okay, anti-vaxxers, whatever. But now I'm really angry because it's such a white Western privilege.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, go live in India, go live in Brazil, and tell me that you don't want this vaccine.
Yeah, I agree. I think what you did it so well in the book, it's Lee's internal dialogue, because she has to be out in it. She has to work. And you can feel the ways that it pisses her off, but she's used to it. And that she just has to overcome it and do her job, you know, of course, you know, that she had gotten sick or whatever herself once. You know, she just had to push through. And it hurt her relationship with her daughter. And I like the way you used it as a back frame, you know. I thought it was done really well.
It hurts, you know. I mean, I guess I should rush to say this is not a pandemic book. This is a thriller.
No, yeah, exactly. That's what I was saying. Yeah.
It just takes place during a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I was really careful because I thought, I mean, you know, it's sort of like violence and sex. If the book doesn't work without it, it doesn't belong in there.
Right.
And so I was really careful to integrate it, but also to talk about Lee's privileged experience with the vaccine.
Yes.
Because she's in a white shoe law firm, and mm-hmm. they're doing social distancing, and they're wearing masks and sanitizing. Her daughter's at this frou-frou mm-hmm. school that she can afford, so the daughter's not doing homeschooling or forced to do a lot of homeschooling, you know, which was the case during the height of the pandemic,
right,
where private schools had the money to stay open, and parents who believed that they should be taking these protocols seriously. So then you contrast that in the book with Lee's sister, Kathy, who lives at the margins of society, and who, to her, being able to take those precautions is a joke. Because it's just not a reality she lives in, where she has that privilege of being able to be careful with her health.
Yeah, that part kind of broke my heart. And it was like, well, obviously Callie's going to take care of her. Callie's going to get it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, but it's true. It's the truth. You have to write the truth. But that brings me to another thing. This is another sister story. And I know you've done it before and you do it very well. As an older sister, I see the younger sister in your writing. Did you really want to write another sister's tale? Like, are they fun for you?
They are, you know, and it's something I can relate to. I'm the youngest of three sisters, so I know how bossy and overbearing older sisters can be.
Not me.
How precious and adorable younger sisters are. But I love that dynamic because I think, especially for women, I mean, let's be honest, women buy 85% of fiction. So I'm writing for them and for the 15% of men who are really sexy and want to know what women are thinking who mm-hmm. read my books. Thank you. But I like that relationship because it brings out a lot. Because as an adult in the world, particularly with Lee, she controls how people perceive her.
Yes.
And so she's a different person with her husband, with her fuck buddy, with her daughter, with the moms at school. You know, she just kind of kaleidoscopes through these different personalities. And she's always in control. And then with her sister, her sister's the one who really sees her. But her sister sees her a certain way. I mean, I don't know if you're this way, probably, because you're a bossy older sister. But you still see your sisters or your siblings as babies.
Kind of. And we went
surprised when they know things.
Well,
like they gotta tie their shoes. Or,
yeah, well, I mean, we lost our dad when we were young, so my sister will always be protective. Of course, it's not a trauma the way the girls in the book go through it, but I think on the feeling of protective towards a sister, I think that's what I related to so much in the book, because I was just kept picturing my sister and going, no, you know, yeah. with the things that happened to Callie, so.
Yeah, well, I think that's also there. I mean, my sister's a very gentle, caring person, mm-hmm. but she would cut a bitch if she really would.
Yeah.
I do the same for her.
I know. Me and my sister are both pretty much cut a bitch people. I think I'm a little bit meaner, obviously, but I just love it, though. The sister relationships are great. Speaking of writing about the pandemic, how about writing during the pandemic? I think it messed with your mojo, right? Like, you usually, like, go off to the cabin for weeks at a time, and it didn't quite work out that way, is what I heard.
Well, I did. I was able to do it a little bit, but, you know, it was very anxiety-making for everybody. And I can only speak to my experience. I mean, my sister got COVID very early on, which was horrible. And I couldn't be around her because I'm immune compromised. So, I mean, that was really, and then we didn't know much about it, how it was transmitted, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was really scary. My father's health is not that great. So I was very worried about him. I mean, I almost cried when he got that first vaccine dose. Phew, done something. So it was very anxiety making, but I'm aware that, like, complaining about it seems kind of bitchy because I didn't have economic insecurity.
No, yeah.
I wasn't out there on the front lines, you know, but I do think if from this really great position where I could ride out the pandemic, I felt so anxious. How horrible it must have been for people who didn't have that choice.
Yes.
You know, someone like Callie who's out mm-hmm. and just thinks, well, if I get it, I get it. Bills still got to be paid. Particularly, you know, I'm always conscious of single moms and how their safety net is just so porous. Like, if you're a single mom and you don't have a parent or someone to watch your kid, you literally cannot get sick for 18 years, right?
Yeah.
You just can't. You don't have that luxury.
Exactly.
So it really made me conscious of that. And, you know, you think about some of these COVID orphans who lost both parents. And I'll tell you what, every author I know dealt with it in a different way. But most of us had trouble writing, except for one. And I will call her name, Mary Kay Andrews. And she was like, oh, this is the first year I finished ahead of time. And I'm like, well, first go fuck yourself.
Yeah. I've watched Shell's interviews. She's hilarious with you. But no, everybody handled it differently.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's like, I can't believe you're saying that. It's just wrong.
I am by nature a deadline junkie, and I kind of took it sometimes that you are too. And it's just how it works. But mine is a weekly deadline, whereas you have a yearly deadline, but you kind of have to, you still prefer to bunch it all up into one place because you need the story to percolate in your mind. And I really relate to that as well.
Yeah, well, I missed my percolating because I didn't realize it took place because, you know, when the shutdown happened, I was scheduled to go to 5 different countries in 2020, and that got canceled immediately for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And I thought, holy shit, I did not realize when I'm in the back of a car or at a gate port or on an airplane, that's when my ideas percolate. So I had to find different times for those ideas to have time to sit in my head and figure out what to do. And you know, as difficult as it was, it was very rewarding. But it made me understand why sometimes my favorite authors deliver a shit book. Because I called my editor. I'm like, look, this is my first time in 21 books that I'm going to be late because I just can't write a shit book. I would rather not have one out this year than deliver it and it's not where I want it to be.
Oh my God.
Fortunately,
yeah.
She's like, you know what? you take your time, we'll figure it out. And it worked out. And but mostly I was mindful of my little translator, Inika Linting in the Netherlands, who's translated me almost from the very beginning. And they do the first edition in the Netherlands. And I just was like on a weekly basis apologizing to her because I was making her
job much harder. I'm sure she loves working with you and that's not a problem.
Well, she was really sweet about it. But, you know, I do feel that responsibility. There are a lot of people whose job depends on me delivering that book.
Yeah.
And it fucks them over if I don't. You know, and I hate to make them scramble. It feels so unprofessional to me, but I was really happy to be able to take time with this book and deliver the story that I wanted to tell.
Well, I think that's really important. It's what your fans expect. I had a similar experience. I missed a deadline for the first time ever last week. I just was not happy with the story and I felt embarrassed and unprofessional and we had to reschedule ads, but it happens and I feel better. The episode got out. It's getting great feedback. And I'm like, I don't want to put out something that I'm not happy with. And I think you're that way too. And I would wait for your book. I don't want a crappy Karen Slaughter book. I've always loved your books and I really respect that. You know, you're not just going to put something out because you need to put something out.
Well, I will say it's a sort of thing though, to be conscious of all those people who depend on you doing your job. So hats off to you.
Yeah, it's I was devastated for a little bit and then I was like, you know what? It's going to be even greater. Everything's going to work out. And they let me move a couple of ads to your interview. I said, well, you know, I've got this interview coming up that's not a regularly scheduled episode. And then they were super excited. So it worked out kind of great.
Fantastic.
Yeah. As much as I love wine, I am intimidated by the huge wall of wine in stores. With so many different brands to choose from, I tend to just grab something familiar and safe. Despite all the different delivery services we use, there is still a common misconception that you can't get wine and spirits delivered to your house. You can, my friend. That's why I love wine.com. I don't feel silly standing in an aisle studying all the brands. I can take my time reading the descriptions and learning about different brands from the comfort of my laptop. And then with my wine.com membership, I order the wine I've chosen and have it shipped right to my door for free. I've been dying to try some celebrity wines I've read about, but aren't available to me locally. So I chose some light summer wines from the Mary J. Blige Sun Goddess collection. With the first few sips, I found myself longing for the beach. Totally worth the hype. For $49 a year, wine.com offers unlimited free shipping when you sign up for a stewardship membership. There is no minimum purchase, and you can also send gift bottles to your family and friends with free shipping throughout the year. And you won't find a wider selection of wines anywhere. Wine.com is the world's largest wine store right at your fingertips. The site offers extensive free professional ratings and tasting notes, and you can live chat with a wine expert to help you find the perfect bottle for every occasion. Go to wine.com/southernfried to get $50 off your order today. Terms apply. That's wine.com/southernfried. Is there something bothering you? Sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. And you can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/Southern. Are you carrying a high credit card balance month after month? You're not the only one. 40% of American families are stuck in some cycle of debt. The high interest rates make it hard to pay off debt, but the lending platform Upstart can help. Upstart is the fast and easy way to pay off your debt with a personal loan, all online. Unlike other lenders, Upstart looks at more than just your credit score, like your income and employment history, giving a more holistic view of your credit worthiness. Which means Upstart can offer smarter rates with trusted partners. Whether you are paying off credit cards, consolidating high interest debt, or funding personal expenses, join the 500,000 people who have used Upstart to get a simple fixed monthly payment. With just a 5-minute online rate check, you can see your rate upfront for loans between $1,000 to $50,000. And you can receive the funds as fast as one business day after accepting your loan. Find out how Upstart can lower your monthly payments today when you go to upstart.com/southernfried. That's upstart.com/southernfried. Don't forget to use our URL to let them know we sent you. Loan amounts will be determined based on your credit, income, and certain other information provided on your loan application. Go to upstart.com/southernfried. Let's talk about Pieces of Her.
Yes.
I'm so excited for you.
I am too. I was able to do a set visit.
Oh, last week.
Yes. And, you know, they were filming in Australia. Mm-hmm. First, they were supposed to film in Vancouver. Then the pandemic happened. And fortunately, Netflix and the producer, Bruna Papandrea, who's an amazing woman, she's from Australia. And she's like, you know what? Let's just do this in Australia.
Right.
And they worked the mojo and got together and moved everything to Australia. The star of the series, Pieces of Her, is Toni Collette. She's Australian.
I love her.
I know. She's amazing. So I didn't get to see all the stuff in Australia for obvious reasons, but they had a week of filming in Georgia because you just can't substitute some things.
No, you
can't. Australia for Georgia.
Yeah.
Mostly our beautiful flip-flopped and barrel-chested and UGA-wearing ball caps supporters. So it was really great that they were able to do that. And I can't wait for it to come out. Please don't ask me when it'll be on.
No, yeah, I wouldn't do that to you.
They have a schedule that I don't know about yet, but, you know, I know they'll do it at the optimal time because they really know what they're doing as far as how to get us addicted to these shows.
The best at that.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it now. I'm super excited.
I think I read that you said that you weren't very much involved in the writing process, that they had a writing team and they kind of had to play with it a little bit to make it work better on screen.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the book is very internalized, and mm-hmm. Andy is the younger woman in the show, in the book, is just riding around in a car feeling sorry for herself, and that doesn't translate well to screen. The woman who plays Andy, Bella Heathcote, is fucking beautiful.
Of course.
And I saw a picture of her in a cop's uniform that on me would make me look like a linebacker, but she was still beautiful, so yeah. I was like, well, okay. That's just life being unfair. But, you know, I didn't want to work on the scripts. I really trust the showrunner, who's the head writer. Her name's Charlotte Stout. She's worked on so many amazing shows like Fosse Verdon, House of Cards, and Homeland.
I love all of those. Yeah.
She's doing. And, you know, I don't really like script writing because it's very collaborative. And I just, you know, I can't focus my brain in that way. I don't want to get notes from anybody but my editor.
Yeah.
With script writing, you get notes from like the guy who brings the coffee and the network. And though I will say, from what I've heard about Netflix, they haven't, you know, you hear horror stories about network execs giving notes just to show they can do it, but everything's extremely helpful. They really love filmmaking and television, and they want to make it better. They're not there to, you know, just put their fingerprints on it. I mean, they're freaking Netflix. They don't have to.
Oh, I know, exactly. Well, and they do a really good job with authors, I believe. Even like, I don't know if you watched Bridgerton, but I didn't realize it was based on those books. And I breezed through those books in a couple of days. Like, I'm not a huge romance novel person, but they're great. They're really funny. And yeah, they did a fantastic job with that.
They were able to catch that humor in a really subtle way.
I'm hoping, I know you've said that Grant County and Will Trent are being developed for TV, but not Netflix. Do we know any more about that, or can we talk
about
that?
I don't know a lot of anything about it. I mean, Pretty Girls has been optioned too.
Yeah.
I think you know when it happens. And for now, I just feel like I've chosen really good people. I mean, honestly, I could have probably sold the Will Trent and Grant County series.
Well, you did before. Didn't you walk away one time when you didn't think it was right? You
know, it just has to be done right.
Yeah.
I'm very mindful that I have this body of work that readers really enjoy. And while, as you said, in Pieces of Her, they had to make changes, I agree with the changes because mm-hmm. it's all about the storytelling and they've captured the essence of the book in a very important way. But I wouldn't trust it with either of those projects with someone who didn't have a similar vision to what I had when I sat down to write the stories.
Well, your fans love those books. And, oh, you know, as upset as they were over Jeffrey, you can just imagine if the TV show didn't come out the way they wanted it to. I wouldn't even want to be the casting director in that. Like, that's crazy. But I've wanted it for so long. They could get so many seasons if they did it out of those books that it's just amazing to me that it hasn't been done yet.
Thank you. Hopefully.
Yeah. The Good Daughter. I thought that one got optioned as well. That's one of my favorites.
It did, you know, but I didn't make it through development. It's really cutthroat sometimes. But we'll see.
It goes back and forth, though.
You never know.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I was going to talk about Save the Libraries. I know that's really close to your heart. I also grew up in libraries and felt saved by libraries. It's part of who I am. You know, speaking of sisters, we were actually at a funeral for an educator with my mom, and this was several years ago, and our librarian from the elementary school recognized me. And I was like in my 30s. And my sister was like, "You are such a dork. They still even know you now. You did never leave the library." And I'm like, that's what made me who I am. And it's so important. So talk to me about Save the Libraries, because I love it.
I started the organization in 2008 during the economic downturn. Well, the not the most recent one, or even the second most recent economic downturn. But I was noticing that a lot of libraries, their hours were being cut, staff was forced into retirement or being let go. And so I just said, well, what can we do to stop that from happening? And initially we did fundraisers, mm-hmm. Lee Child, Tess Gerritsen, Charlene Harris, who's a wonderful Southern lady.
Oh, I love her work.
You know, Kitty Stockett, a Southern lady. Mary Kay Andrews, an asshole. We did all these fundraisers. And then we realized that a lot of libraries, when they do fundraisers, they spend the money they raise on the events. We'll pay for the events.
Yeah.
And then we thought, well, why are we doing this? Let's just give them the money. So that's what we do now. We give block grants. We've given my local library, the DeKalb Friends of the Library System, about $250,000. So we just try to do Lord's work and keep these places open. Because, you know, I don't like children. I find them annoying. But we need them to be fluent readers, because if you develop reading skills early in life, it benefits you for the rest of your life. You
absolutely.
Know, you develop pathways in your brain that will not develop otherwise. You know, there's a finite amount of time in which a child can develop those pathways, and you can't unfuck a goat. You know, once they don't have those, they're never going to grow them. So,
yeah, you're either a reader or you're not a reader. You find that in adults.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, and it in the end, it benefits me because they're going to buy my books.
Yeah.
They're very smart. And also, they're going to help pay for my Medicare and my Social Security.
That's
so
right.
It's a very small investment in order to make sure that I can retire and not eat cat food.
And also, like, I have to ask, because my fans love Dolly Parton. I do, too. And I have a feeling you do. You did make the one Jeffrey got caught cheating with. Her name was Jolene, and she was a sign maker. I did catch that.
Yes.
I know you're a sign maker.
Yes, absolutely.
And Dolly does the Imagination Library, and it's to help, you know, the underprivileged. And I just love that. And I assume you're a good fan, too. So,
absolutely.
I wanted to bring it up for them.
It's pretty common among crime writers to be Dolly fans. Because many years ago, Gillian Flynn and I spent, like, the first 2 hours of us getting to know each other talking about Dolly and how great she is.
If you don't worship Dolly, what is wrong with you? Like, I've got a photo of her over my desk looking over me. I mean, she's protecting me.
She's amazing. But, you know, my dream is to go to Dollywood and meet her.
Well, I'm going to Pigeon Forge next week. I wish I could. I don't know, with my back and all that. The kids are probably going to, and my husband will do like the roller coasters, but maybe she'll be in town. Wouldn't it be so great? We're going to go to the Stampede, her restaurant, and all that stuff. Right. But I'm really excited. As close as I live, I've never been. So it's only about a 4-hour drive, 3.5, 4-hour drive for me.
Worth it.
I'm really excited. I would die to meet her. Like, she's just an amazing person.
I would hope I wouldn't be one of those that just burst into tears and
I would. I would.
I was rendered unfunctioning when I met Carol Burnett.
Oh God, I bet.
Yeah, I was at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, and I saw her across like a field almost. And I was with Alifair Burke, who says that I leapt like a Giselle to see her. And I got a picture of me with Carol Burnett, and she's holding her purse in her lap like she's afraid I'm going to take it. Crazy.
Well, you never know when somebody comes up a running. No, that's hilarious. There's definitely people I'm positive I would burst into tears. I get a little nervous when I first start talking to you, and then we get going and the cursing starts and we're all good. So would love to meet you in person again one day too. Well, before we go, today's the day. I'm so excited. I got my pre-copy. Anything else?
Well, I hope people love the book. And if you don't, I don't want to hear about it.
Keep it to yourself.
You can post a picture of the book with your animal of choice.
Nice.
That includes a spouse. I mean, whatever you desire. If you could just post it and tag me, I'd love to see it.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations. Like I said, every time you write a standalone, I always think it's, this one's now my favorite. It's excellent. It really is. And I kind of had to read through it twice to make my notes and get my bearings. But congratulations, you did an excellent job. And I know through a horrific experience, even though we're privileged, it was hard to do it. So I totally understand that.
Well, high praise indeed. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It was so good to talk to you again. Hope to see you soon when the world is less crazy.
Yeah. All right. Let me know how Dollywood goes, man.
I will.
Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Karen Slaughter for taking time out of her grueling Zoom schedule to chat with me. She couldn't tour this year because of the pandemic, but luckily she's generous with her time in Zoom chats, and she's looking forward to getting back out there to meet her fans. Don't forget to check out her new book, False Witness, which is out today, July 20th, and the paperback edition of The Silent Wife, the latest book in her Will Trent series, is out everywhere now. As some of you already know, Facebook shut down our lovely group, but we have already started a new one. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We will still be worshiping our patron saint, Dolly Parton, sharing recipes, and in general, being supportive and good to each other. I still intend for it to be a safe and fun corner of Facebook, so the rule is, no shit ass is allowed. And please remember, if you invite friends to the group, to make sure they know to answer the security questions. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.